From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a bit of a spoiler, but every story has to have a villain. And for Robert Lustig, in the story of the world's obesity epidemic, the villain is sugar. In his book, Lustig says sugar is the Professor Moriarty of this story. It's the substance that permeates nearly all of our food these days. And not to put too fine a point on it, but Lustig says it's killing us. In order to deal with the problem, though, Lustig says we have to understand how we got here in the first place. So today in the program, he's joining us to explain. There's the science part of the story, that is, why it is that sugar is making us fat. But there's also history and politics here. Lustig calls it a perfect storm for our health that has altered our biochemistry and driven our eating habits out of control. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Robert Lustig's book isn't just about sugar, though it is the main villain in the story of the world's obesity pandemic, and we are going to spend a lot of time on it today. But there's a lot going on in the story, and Lustig says everyone seems to be blaming everyone else for what's happening. Big Food, he says, is blaming this lack of activity, computer games and things. The Atkins people say it's carbs. Other people say it's fat. Schools, he says, blame inattentive parents. Parents say it's schools. For Robert Lustig, the point is trying to reconcile all of these opinions into one cohesive whole that makes sense, and that's what his book is about. Today in the program, Robert Lustig is with us. His book is called Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Foods, Obesity, and Disease. Robert Lustig is a pediatric endocrinologist at UC San Francisco, a noted expert on obesity. He's joining us today from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco, and Dr. Lustig, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
Well, I guess I wanted to start by asking you about your involvement in this story, because you point out in your book that you didn't start out as an advocate. How did you start getting interested in all of this?
Well, look, I'm a neuroendocrinologist. I've been a neuroendocrinologist pretty much since I was in seventh grade when I did a term paper on the hypothalamus. I said, wow, this is cool.
Right.
The brain controls all the hormonal functions of the body. And then I learned how the hormones controlled the brain. Yeah. And obesity is the ultimate expression of this crosstalk between brain and body. Mm-hmm. The problem was we didn't understand obesity even remotely until 1994. And that was when the hormone leptin was discovered. And yeah. Leptin is a hormone that goes from your fat cell to your brain and tells your brain how much energy you've got on board so you can determine how much energy you can afford to expend.
Right.
In essence, leptin is the starvation hormone. Leptin tells your brain you have enough energy to burn. If your leptin levels are low, or if your brain can't see that leptin because there's something blocking that signal, your brain sees starvation. And as it turns out, obesity is brain starvation. Your body's, you know, socking it away, but your brain doesn't know it. Your brain thinks you're starving, and so you keep eating, and the process goes out of control. It's a vicious cycle. The question was, what prevents leptin from getting to the brain in order for the brain to be able to interpret it?
That was the crucial. That was the
holy
grail.
Story.
Yeah, yeah.
Crucial story. This is the holy grail of neuroendocrinology, all the way from the 60s, basically, as far as I'm concerned, until the mid 2000s. Our research showed that when we dropped the hormone insulin. Now, insulin is the energy storage hormone. Right. It's the hormone that actually drives that fat gain. When we drop that with drugs or with diet, all of a sudden leptin started working again. So it turned out through a lot of very fancy science that I did and also many other people did, insulin is the blocker of leptin signaling. So then the question became in the mid-2000s, okay. We are now all releasing about 2 to 3 times the amount of insulin that we used to, say, even 30 years ago, wow, before this obesity epidemic. It was always assumed that that increased amount of insulin that we're releasing is because we're obese, as opposed to the other way around.
Right.
In other words, the insulin was a response to the obesity rather than the cause of the obesity. That was what was assumed. We showed otherwise. We showed that insulin was the cause. So then we had to ask, all right, why is the insulin up?
Yeah.
And that's when everything coalesced and we realized, hey, it's the sugar.
Right.
And all of the data that's come in since then has basically been highly supportive, and we now have causative data. We now have causation for chronic metabolic disease. Now, let me make a point very early on in our discussion.
Okay.
It's not about obesity. Everyone thinks it's about obesity, and the food industry wants it to be about obesity because if it's about obesity, they can hide behind lack of sidewalks, lack of PE in schools, iPads, iPods, you know, crackberries, blackberries, and everything else that has come about during the last 30 years as the true cause of the obesity epidemic, and they do. When you look at the data on sugar and weight gain, it's there, but it's very minor. It's not big. It's about worth about 0.8 BMI points.
Right.
But we have a 7 to 8 BMI point problem. So sugar is one of the causes of obesity. It is certainly not the cause. And I've never said it was the cause of obesity.
Yeah.
But what we have shown is that sugar is the cause of diabetes. Sugar is the cause of chronic metabolic disease because of the way it's metabolized in cells, because of how it affects peripheral energy metabolism completely differently from that of glucose and completely differently from that of virtually every other foodstuff. It's not the only one, but it is the big one and it's the most actionable one. Mm-hmm. It's the one that the food industry adds specifically for its own purposes. And that's why I have spent so much time talking about this as a sugar problem because of diabetes. And that's where the money goes.
Right. I wanted to ask, there's a cultural component to this story that you talk about this kind of myth related to obesity, and you mentioned that it's not about obesity, but it's also, you hear a lot of this, that obesity is about gluttony and sloth, and it's a behavioral
sure.
aberration. But in the sure. book, you write about this thesis of personal responsibility, this idea that the average person who's gaining weight in the current environment isn't a perpetrator. He or she is a victim.
That's right. And I can do this very quickly in a thought experiment with you.
Yeah.
Okay, Doug, you're not too heavy. I've seen pictures of you. Let's take you for a minute. Okay. You eat 2,000 calories a day. You burn 2,000 calories a day. You feel good. It's a normal day.
Right.
Are you going to gain weight, lose weight, or stay the same?
I'm going to stay the same.
Right. You burn what you eat, nothing to store, you stay the same. Okay, now let's do the thought experiment. I'm going to put an intravenous line in your arm. I'm going to tape it down. I'm going to follow behind you all day. And every time you reach for food, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, I am going to pump you full of extra insulin that your body didn't want or need. More insulin than your pancreas would have made if it had done it alone.
Yeah.
I am going to over-insulinize you. That's the new Doug Fabrizio.
Right.
You start out the day eating 2,000 calories just like before. But now, because of the extra insulin I'm pumping you full of, 500 of those 2,000 calories get wiped out of the bloodstream straight to fat right off the top, just like what the IRS does to your paycheck. Gone before you had a chance to spend it. In this case, gone before you had a chance to burn it. You are now 500 calories heavier, whether you like it or not. If you stood on the scale, you'd weigh a 1/7 of a pound more because of what I did to you. Now, you ate 2,000, but you lost 500 to your fat, like Robin Hood. Now, how many do you have left to burn? 1,500.
1,500, yeah.
But your body wants to burn 2,000 because that's where it feels good. And this is the nugget of truth. How many calories you burn and how good you feel are synonymous. They are the same thing. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good,
right.
Like ephedrine off the market, caffeine for 2 hours, exercise. Things that make your energy expenditure go down make you feel lousy,
yeah.
Like Hypothyroidism, starvation. So you, Doug Fabrizio, now only have 1,500 calories to burn. So what do we call it when your body has fewer calories than it wants to burn? It's called starvation. Yeah. That's starvation. So how do you feel when you're starved? Crappy, tired, slothy, sit on the couch, don't want to do anything, don't want to exercise, maybe play video games. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And of course, hungry.
Right.
So in a world of free access to food, which we all live in, what are you, Doug Fabrizio, going to go do? You're going to eat back the 500.
Right.
So now you're eating 2,500 instead of 2,000, except, haha, I'm still pumping you full of extra insulin. 100 of those 500 get diverted straight to fat. Now you're 600 calories heavier. You're only up to 1,900 to burn. You still don't feel great. You go to a doctor, you go to a nutritionist, you say, Doc, I don't get it. I keep gaining weight and I don't feel so good. Why am I fat? And the doctor looks at your behaviors, which are now an outcome measure of the biochemical change, and say, well, you're a glutton and a sloth.
Yeah.
You eat too much and you exercise too little. And guess what? You are. You are now. But not because you chose to, not because you want to.
Yeah.
It's because you have to. It's a biochemical drive set up by the high insulin I pumped you full of. The behaviors were secondary to the biochemistry, not the other way around. The behaviors were a readout of the biochemical change that had taken place in your body. And it's always true. That is what I learned in neuroendocrinology over 30 years, is that all behavior is biochemistry. And when you understand the biochemistry, then you understand the behavior.
Well, you've pointed out, in fact, we have this epidemic of obese six-month-olds. It's hard to blame a six-month-old for being obese.
Well, you know what? If their insulin is high, they'll get obese. And now they have about seven different reasons for their insulin to be high, including mother's diet.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to make them a perpetrator? Is that what you want to do? Is that what our society wants to do? How about the obese newborn? Turns out, body weight, birth weight is up 200 grams all over the world over the past 25 years. Russia, South Africa, Israel, the United States. And when you do DEXA scanning on newborns, you find out that those 200 grams are all fat. Where did the fat come from? It came from the kid's insulin, which came from the mother's diet. Kid's already fat. Kid is just born. You want to make him a perpetrator too? Get off it.
Yeah.
Get with the program. Understand the science.
Let's talk about, you lay out this kind of, what you call this perfect storm of these kind of three political winds that get, even before we get to the biochemistry, which I want to talk about, this part of it. And I want to start with Richard Nixon. The Nixon administration admonishing his, basically what he wants to do, and I want you to lay this out for us, is he wants to take Nixon, you say, he wants to take food out of the political equation, that is, make food cheap.
He wants to make food cheap. That's exactly what he wants. And the reason is because he knew that fluctuating food prices cause political unrest. And that's been true throughout history. And I can prove it. Just 5 years ago, we diverted some of our corn crop to ethanol. That actually changed the price of rice in Thailand and caused rice riots and caused the ouster of their prime minister. Now, that prime minister may have needed ousting. That's not the issue. The point is that was a direct and proximate cause. Fluctuating food prices cause political unrest. And if you look at the U.S. Producer Price Index for sugar prior to Nixon's policy, it was all over the place, up, down, up, down. Mm. And part of that was because of the sugar tariff, and part of that was because of competing international markets. Bottom line. High fructose corn syrup came in 1975, and it stabilized everything because now there was competition.
Right.
Now sugar became cheap. And because it became cheap, sugar started appearing in all sorts of foods that never had it before. And then we went low fat back in the late 1970s because we were told to by the McGovern Commission, who said that dietary fat caused cardiovascular disease, which turns out to be completely untrue. The fat hypothesis has been debunked by the American Heart Association. But back then, when we went low fat, well, the food tastes like cardboard when you take the fat out. They had to do something to make the food palatable, add the sugar.
Right.
And that's where we got Entenmann's fat-free cakes. That's right, where we got Snackwells. And, you know, sadly, these things are still with us. And low-fat dressings. Look how much sugar is in a low-fat dressing. As far as I'm concerned, if something says low-fat, it's poison.
You know, it's
period.
This idea, so high fructose corn syrup is one of those things that comes in this second wave that you write about. You mentioned it gets into the American market in the 1970s, 1975.
Yep.
Invented in Japan in 1966.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And took the world by storm.
Yeah.
And the reason was, number one, we needed more sugar. And number two, the Caribbean sugar crop was decimated in 1980 by Hurricane Allen. Third worst hurricane in American history. Everybody knows Katrina and Sandy. Hurricane Allen didn't even hit our shores, but it wiped out the Caribbean sugar crop. And so Coca-Cola, Pepsi, everybody else said, oh my God, our sugar supply is tenuous. We have a problem. We need something that is American homegrown. And of course, high fructose corn syrup was on the horizon. It was already here. It just was not being used very much. Well, this started the change. This started the addition. And by 1985, the substitution of high fructose corn syrup for sucrose, for table sugar, in virtually all American foods was complete. And that was, of course, the rollout of what was known as, quote, New Coke,
right,
unquote. And New Coke was HFCS. That's what it was. We revolted because it was so sweet. So they then brought back Coke Classic. Well, you know, Coke Classic disappeared. You know what Coke is now? It's New Coke.
Hmm.
Okay, they just don't call it that.
So the idea is that, I mean, but if you think about the basic concept of high fructose corn syrup, it is sweeter. So mm-hmm. you would think we would want less of it.
Indeed. It's sweeter. So you should be able to use less, but we don't. We use more. And that's exactly the point. In fact, high fructose corn syrup is supposed to be either 42 or 55% fructose, the sweet molecule in
right.
sugar. But now we're finding out that some dispenser drinks, like in McDonald's and other and 7-Elevens, may be up to 65%. And they're actually finding signs of high fructose corn syrup 90 in certain places as well. This is supposed to be an industrial use where you're supposed to dilute it out, but they're using it full strength. Why are they doing this? And the answer is very, very complex, but I can sum it up in one word. It's called addiction. Sugar's addictive.
Yeah.
Mildly so. Kind of like alcohol, not for everybody, and, you know, in high dose, but for some people, it's addictive. It does all of the things to the brain that alcohol does, that nicotine does, that cocaine does, that street drugs do. It downregulates dopamine receptors. It changes dopamine neurotransmission, which is the reward neurotransmitter, the one that makes you feel good, so that the next time you need more of the same substance to get the same level of reward. That's called tolerance. And then when you take it away, you get physiologic symptoms. That's called withdrawal. And tolerance and withdrawal, that equals addiction. So they supplied it, we got hooked, and now they're upping the dose.
You've talked about going into, you know, a regular sort of typical grocery store and how hard it is to find even surprising things like hamburger buns and bread that yeah. don't have sugar or high fructose corn syrup these days.
Indeed. If Barry Popkin at the University of North Carolina published a study last year that showed that of the 600,000 items in the American grocery store today, 80% are laced with added sugar. 80%. Virtually every commercially available bread has added sugar. The question is why. Bakery bread doesn't have added sugar, but commercially available bread does.
Right.
Now, one of the reasons is because the sugar takes the place of the water, and so it actually increases moisture. It's called humectancy. So it increases shelf life. So sugar is a preservative and allows food to stay on the shelves longer. And of course, that's good for the Grocery Manufacturers Association, and it's good for the manufacturers, the producers themselves, because it decreases depreciation. And what they would say is, well, that's good for the customer because we can sell it for less. And if you're only worried about your wallet and your pocketbook, that would be true. But if you're worried about your health, let me tell you something. You're going to spend a whole lot more in your diabetes.
Yeah.
Like the Fram oil filter commercial. You can pay me now or you can pay me later.
Right. This idea, this third element, this idea that plays into this perfect storm, what happens in the 1980s, which you mentioned, and this call by these various agencies, USDA, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, they all say, look, we need to reduce our consumption of fat. And there are a number of, you talk about how this was a real fight going on at the time. But it seems like the idea of fat being the enemy is the thing that wins out. What's going on? It involves this study that you've talked about by Ansel Keys. But there's this counterview also, this important book called Pure White and Deadly. So there is this kind of battle going on. It looks like Ansel Keys wins for a time.
Well, in fact, Ansel Keys won back in the late 1970s. The thing is, we're taking it back. Yeah. The data is just so overwhelmingly obvious. Here's the problem. Low fat means low all fat. There are seven different classes of fat. There's omega-3s, which are heart healthy. They will save your life. There are monounsaturated fats, which actually help your liver work better. There are polyunsaturated fats, which have some significant improvements, although if you overdo it, you can have immune problems. There's saturated fat, which everyone said caused cardiovascular disease, and that has been debunked by the American Heart Association. It is cardiovascularly neutral. Then there are medium-chain triglycerides, which you find in palm oil and other nut oils. Then there is omega-6s, which are pro-inflammatory and contribute to the heart disease process, and they're found in corn-fed beef. And then finally, there is trans fats, which are the devil incarnate, which are things that the food industry specifically adds to increase shelf life because the bacteria can't digest them. Well, neither can you.
Right.
So seven different classes of fat. When you go low fat, you remove all of them. You remove the good ones, like the omega-3s, and what do you substitute? You substitute sugar, which makes liver fat and only the bad ones. So what you've done is you've traded something that's kind of got a mixed bag for something that is highly toxic all the way across. Which is worse, the fat or the sugar? The sugar, by far.
And you say we've based 30 years of nutrition education and policy on that idea that was flawed.
That's right. And it was based on correlational data, not causational data. And there were scientists who were very concerned about making this jump back then. And we made it anyway. And there were lots of reasons why we made it, mostly political. And the bottom line is correlation is not causation. Now, people will argue that I don't have causation for sugar being the cause of diabetes. And I would argue, oh, yes, we do. In fact, we've done that work. It was published this February in the journal Plus One. And we showed that sugar is the proximate cause of diabetes worldwide, exclusive of total calories and exclusive of its effect on obesity. Very specifically, sugar and nothing else in the diet. And sugar is 11 times more potent than total calories in causing diabetes in any given individual worldwide. That is big.
Dr. Robert Lustig is with us. He's a pediatric endocrinologist at UC San Francisco. His book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Foods, Obesity, and Disease. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dr. Robert Lustig is with us to make the case for why sugar is a poison, a toxin. It's not just hyperbole. He says it's a biochemical fact. His book is called Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. So I want to ask you about one of the things you've talked about is early on in the conversation about this, you've talked about you ask this question, what do the Atkins diet and the traditional Japanese diet have in common? Because they're diametrically opposed. You have the Atkins diet, which is high in fat, low in carbohydrates. The Japanese diet, which is high in carbohydrates, low mostly in fat. But this is a point that sort of leads us to fructose, and I wanted you to sort of talk about this.
Right. If you take a look at any diet that actually works, and there are many diets that work.
Yeah.
The two you've mentioned, the glycemic index diet, the South Beach diet, Sugar Busters diet, Paleolithic diet, and down the line. I mean, and there are a whole bunch of diets that have data that are supportive. They all share two things in common. And it's not about the macronutrients. It's not about the fat and the carbohydrate. What they share in common is that they are all low-sugar, high-fiber diets. Low-sugar, high-fiber. Every single diet that works is low-sugar, high-fiber. There are no diets that are the opposite, that are good for you, that are high-sugar, low-fiber. That doesn't exist. The Twinkie diet does not work. But low-sugar, high-fiber. But so what is a low-sugar, high-fiber diet called? It's called real food.
Yeah.
That's what God gave us. That's what nature gave us. And what I'm saying is all food, real food, is inherently good. It's what we do to the food that's not. And unfortunately, that is the job of the food industry, is to process the food in such a way as to, number one, make it palatable, number two, make it saleable. And they don't really care otherwise, because it's about their, you know, quarterly profits. And so what has happened is that we have taken real food and we have basically reduced it to a substance which sustains our lives in terms of energy, mm-hmm. but not in terms of health. I re-envision a world where food conveys wellness, not illness. That's where we need to go.
You know, one of the things you talk about in regards to this is the removal of fiber, the importance of fiber. And you've pointed out we used mm-hmm. to consume, I can't remember what, something like 100 to 300 grams of fiber a day. And now
we consume 12 grams? Right. The data from DNA footprinting of stool that's been found in caves, you know, people, you know, died 50,000 years ago, you can actually figure out, you know, what the bacteria were so you could figure out what the diet was.
Right.
And based on those results, people estimate that, you know, we used to consume about 100 grams of fiber per day.
Right.
And now we're at 12. And the thing is that that fiber has been removed from our diet specifically by the food industry for its own purposes, because you can't freeze fiber. Try it. Take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight, put it on your counter the next morning and thaw it. Try to eat it. See what you get. You get mush. Why do you get mush? The ice crystals form inside the cell wall, macerate the cell wall, allow the water to rush in as the orange thaws, turns it to mush. You wouldn't eat that. But if you squeeze it and freeze it, hey, it lasts forever. And that's the point. Decreased depreciation for the food industry. They can take any orange and sell it even 5 years later. So they can sell it for cheaper because the depreciation's down, and we're happy to buy it at a lower cost. Good for your wallet, bad for your health.
Let's take some calls. Chris is with us in Provo. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sure.
Forgive me because I just tuned in just very recently. But the reason I'm calling is I'm the parent of two kids with type 1 diabetes. And mm-hmm. when you're referring to the research that indicated that sugar was worldwide the leading cause or one of the main causes for diabetes, is that specific to type 2 diabetes, or did that include type 1 as well?
Right. Let me make that very clear.
Yeah.
The data set that we used was from the International Diabetes Federation, and they do not distinguish between type 1 and type 2. So the data do not allow us to make that distinction. However, I can promise you that it is type 2 diabetes we're talking about, which is 90% of diabetes in the world. Type 1 is an autoimmune disease, one I take care of as a pediatric endocrinologist, which is due to an immune dysfunction that destroys the beta cells of the pancreas and is not related to sugar. So let all the type 1 parents out there, I've gotten enough hate mail over the years from you for having said that sugar is the proximate cause of diabetes worldwide, which is true. It is not the proximate cause of type 1 diabetes. Don't worry, you're off the hook.
Chris, glad you called. Claudia is with us calling from Orem. Claudia, hi.
Hi. I had just a question about artificial sweeteners and natural sweeteners like stevia and what they do to your insulin levels.
Yeah. You're right about this, Dr. Lustig.
Super, super question. And the very short answer is we don't know.
Right.
It's not that we don't know. It's that we specifically don't know because the data don't exist. Let me explain why. And that's actually very, very to the point. There's something called pharmacokinetics, and there's something called pharmacodynamics. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They're not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the FDA demands them. You can't get a diet sweetener on the market without supplying those because those have to do with acute toxicity. Those pharmacokinetic studies tell you if you're going to keel over and die. And that's the FDA's job, is to protect food safety for acute issues and acute toxins. However, their charter, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, specifically says that they are not interested in chronic toxicity. And that's where pharmacodynamics would come in. So the FDA does not ask for those studies to be done. The food industry says, why in the world would we do these studies? They're long-term, they're complicated to do, and they can't help our sales. Well, if the FDA is not going to ask for them, we're not going to do them. And then the NIH comes along and says, hey, this is the food industry's job. We're not going to pay for something that they ought to be doing. So we have an FDA who doesn't ask for them, we have a food industry who won't do them, and we have an NIH who won't pay for them. No data. Now, having said that, there is a little bit of data starting to squeak out. And let me just tell you about one study that was done. It was published in April in Diabetes Care by Yanina Pepino from Washington University, St. Louis. And what she did was she took 17 morbidly obese adults who did not have diabetes, and she did glucose tolerance testing on them two different days, about a week apart, once with a diet soda pretreatment and once without. And the question was, did the glucose tolerance test change when the diet soda was pretreatment was added? And the answer was absolutely. There was 20% more insulin released despite the fact that there were no calories in that diet soda. So what that's telling us, we think, is that the sweet taste sends a signal from your tongue to your brain and tells your brain a sugar bolus is coming. And so your brain then tells your pancreas through the vagus nerve, which is the nerve that connects your brain and all of your abdominal organs, including your pancreas, hey, sugar bolus is coming, release more insulin. But then the sugar bolus doesn't come, pancreas releases it anyway, and that drives weight gain. So there's very big reason to be concerned that switching from sugared beverages to diet soda is not such a good idea.
Let's see, Michelle with us in Salt Lake City. Michelle, hi.
Hi, I was wondering about orange juice. I understand that orange juice isn't healthy because you basically take all of the fiber and the good stuff out of it. But what about high
Correct.
Pulp orange juice?
Doesn't matter. Once it's dissociated, it's basically the same. And they've actually shown that if you eat the whole fruit, you're in fine shape. Once you do anything to the fruit in terms of processing, whether it be blending it, like in a high pulp orange juice, or even cooking it, it releases the sugars. They are now not part of the fiber matrix anymore. There was a study that was done where they looked at what happened to your insulin when you ate an apple, applesauce, or apple juice. Now, the applesauce still has fiber in it, right? Turns out the applesauce was just like the apple juice and nothing like the apple.
So one of the things you've talked about is the idea that nature provides the antidote with the poison. That's what fruit is about. And we're getting a lot of questions related to fruit. People are saying, can I have fruit? And the idea is
whole fruit.
Yeah.
Whole fruit. Real fruit. Fruit that came off the tree. The question is, when you turn it into a smoothie, what do? Well, you destroy the insoluble fiber. The strands are sheared to smithereens, and you need that insoluble fiber. It forms a latticework on the inside of your intestine that reduces the rate of absorption of the sugar into the bloodstream. That keeps the liver safe and the insulin down. So keeping the fiber intact is absolutely crucial to fruit being valuable to you. And that only comes in whole fruit. The minute you do something to it, like juicing it or smoothieing it, it's out the window.
Yeah. What do you say about fiber supplements? Do you recommend those for people?
No, I don't. Yeah. Now, fiber does two things, and there are two kinds of fiber. There's soluble fiber, which is like pectins, like what holds jelly together. And then there's insoluble fiber, which is like cellulose, the green stuff in celery. You need both. Here's why. In the book, I liken it to the hair catcher on your bathtub drain. It's a plastic latticework with holes in it, right? If you take a shower and you're hairy, you're going to plug up your bathtub drain. You have to clean it. And that forms a barrier to the water going down. Now, if you don't have the latticework there, if you take the hair catcher out, the water goes down the drain, ultimately clogs it. That's not so good. If you just run water through the latticework and you don't take a shower, the water will go down because the holes are open. In order to get that barrier to work, you need the latticework and the plugs. So you need the insoluble fiber, which is the latticework, and you need the soluble fiber, which is the hair, plug in the holes. When you have the two together, and that's what whole fruit gives you, is both, then you have that gel, that barrier that causes the nutrients to be absorbed slower and further down the intestine so that the intestinal bacteria can chew some of them up instead of you. In other words, it works for you.
Thanks very much. An email from Susan who writes, manufacturers use concentrated apple juice and other fruit juices to increase sugar, yet she says they can label these products as no added sugar. It's deceptive, she
Absolutely.
Says.
Absolutely. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the ebook, Sugar Has 56 Names, A Shopper's Guide. There are 56 different names for sugar. And I guarantee you, you don't know them. Stephen Colbert said he knew them, but I guarantee you, you don't know them. And they can use all of them to basically, you know, use them as subterfuge for what they're doing. Absolutely. They can say use concentrated orange juice or anything else, and they can say no added sugar. You are absolutely right. They can do that. There are also names for sugar that you've never heard of, like ethyl maltol or diatase or a whole bunch of other things that are demerara, turbinado, all sorts of things you've never heard of. And worse yet, they have to list on the ingredients list each substance that's in the food in order of mass. So, you know, you could put a different kind of sugar as number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8, number 9. When you add it all up, it's number 1. And you can't know it. And you can't read that. And most of the time, you can't even read the label because it's so small. And you can't deal with it. This is a major problem. Now, I will tell you that there is a bill in the House right now called the Food Labeling Modernization Act of 2013, which has been proffered by Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut. We will see what kind of politicking gets done around this issue over the course of the next couple of months.
Dr. Robert Lustig is with us. His book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Foods, Obesity, and Disease. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Robert Lustig. We're talking about his book, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Let's go back to the phones. Mary Ann is with us in Cedar Hills. Mary Ann, welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wondered if he would comment on honey or like agave and if that is similar to the processed sugars he's talking about, if it has the same health risks, or just if you could comment on those, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Great. This is a huge point, and this is one of those points you talk about, you know, this idea. We figure agave's got to be better for you, or honey's got to be different in some way, but talk about that. Sugar is sugar, I guess.
Indeed, they are the same. Calorie for calorie, ounce for ounce, gram for gram, it makes absolutely no difference. They are sucrose. They are glucose, fructose, either free or bound, but they ultimately do the exact same thing. Now, as it turns out, honey, agave, maple syrup, etc., are more expensive, and they have their own unique flavors, so people tend to use less of them. And anything that causes you to use less of them, as far as I'm concerned, is a good thing. I would caution you about agave. Agave is 75% fructose. So it is even sweeter, but it's also more dangerous because the fructose moiety is the problem moiety. That's the thing that causes the liver fat accumulation. So I am not a fan of these natural sweeteners in any more than I am not a fan of table sugar or high fructose corn syrup. You just have to be very careful with them. They are supposed to be flavor enhancers, not the flavor itself.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. Dave, go ahead.
I recently was listening to like the Diane Rehm show, and I remember, or at least I think it was Diane Rehm's, and they were talking about how they have put an opiate receptor on the wheat. So the wheat now that we're eating is also GMO. So the gentleman's saying eat more wheat and stuff and eat more grains, but a lot of the grains that are out there are also genetically modified to where we consume more because there is
an
opiate receptor has been kind of stuck in there on the gene, and it's not the same grain that our grandmothers were eating. And I think, in fact, that was the title of the article, you know, the grains we eat now are not the same as our grandmothers. And, in fact, it may have actually been on Umanu, I'm not sure, but I just recently heard it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's been a conflict for me to figure out, well, eat more grains, but if the grains are GMO and there's an opiate receptor stuck on the gene and we're eating this stuff, our brain is saying, oh, this is opium. Hey, give me more. Can we address that?
Well, first of all, I haven't said eat more grains. What I've said is eat more fiber. The fiber can come in many, many other versions other than grains. Certainly, whole grains are better than refined carbohydrate. And there are many whole grains like beans, lentils, farro, nuts that are not grains and that are not wheat. I think that, you know, we are wheat obsessed in America. I know that William Davis wrote a book called Wheat Belly. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things in that book that I contest, but from the standpoint of what is the problem, I would much rather see consumption of fiber in with things that are not carbohydrate containing. So I am not saying eat more grains. I am saying eat more fiber. Now, in terms of this specific opiate receptor issue, this is a very complex issue. It's not clear to me yet that this has any meaningful effect on increased consumption. No one's shown a direct link between the fact that they've done this transgenic opiate receptor and increased consumption. You would have to show me the data before I would be able to comment on that.
Mm. David, thanks. All right, let's see. Chase with us in Sandy. Chase, hi.
Oh, thank you. So my question is, during my wife's first pregnancy, she had gestational diabetes, and of course her diet consisted of all sorts of different sweets and whatnot. This time around, we're watching her diet a lot more, and her glucose levels are normal. My question is, how is that going to affect the child's life? Is it going to be different? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Right. The bottom line is, we have seen that when mothers have gestational diabetes, that glucose crosses the placenta, and that means that the baby's beta cells in their pancreas have to work harder. And these babies tend to be much larger. And so we have a whole huge increase in what we call macrosomia. That is, babies born more than 4 kilos. And it's a huge problem with patients, with mothers of with gestational diabetes. And these babies are three times more likely to become obese and have metabolic syndrome than the general population. So keeping mother's blood sugar under control during pregnancy is absolutely essential. But what's also essential is keeping mother's sugar consumption during pregnancy low so that fructose doesn't cross the placenta and drive liver fat accumulation even in the newborn. Mm-hmm. So mother's diet is absolutely paramount, and we are not giving this any play at all in the medical field or in nutrition at all.
Chase, thanks. So we've talked about one of the antidotes to this fructose effect, fiber, of course. There's another one that you write about in the book, exercise being the other half of that antidote. But I want you to talk about this because there is a myth associated, as you put it, with exercise, which goes back to that idea that a calorie is a calorie, so right. Exercise should cause weight loss. Talk about how exercise fits into all of this.
Right. If a calorie were a calorie, that is, if it didn't matter where those calories came from, you know, whether it comes from carrots or cheesecake or Coca-Cola, if a calorie were a calorie, then if you exercised, you'd lose weight, except for one thing. There is not one single study on the planet which shows that exercise alone causes weight loss. If anything, exercise alone causes weight gain. Why is that? Because exercise does not cause weight loss. It causes muscle gain. Now, muscle is really good. Muscle has mitochondria. Mitochondria burn energy so that you don't make liver fat. Mitochondria are the key to the kingdom. You want your mitochondria to be numerous and efficient. You want them to be working properly. And new muscle, building muscle, does that in spades. But it's going to increase your weight. So I have lots of patients who, you know, told me that their doctor said, well, if you'd only exercise, you'd lose weight. Well, then they exercise and they don't lose weight, and they say, oh, must not work for me. And so they stop exercising. And of course, because they're depressed, they go eat more. So exercise is the single best thing that any person can do for themselves. I am totally for exercise. In fact, this past weekend, I gave the keynote speech at Anytime Fitness and told them, you are doing the right thing. You just need to do it better. And the reason you need to do it better is because you need to tell your clients, you're doing this for wellness, not for weight loss. And when they understand that, they'll get with the program and everyone will be better off.
You write, Dr. Lustig, that this is a very similar story to the tobacco story. You know, the food industry profiting, you say, at the expense of the health of others. And you say that, of course, we know states went after big tobacco. And you put it this way in your book, that when it comes to big food, it's time for that trial. But but you also say you're not really holding your breath for those kinds of prosecutions.
Well, you know, things are starting to move. I got to tell you, people are starting to get the picture. Just last week, the International Investment Bank Credit Suisse published a Research Institute report. I'm holding it, in fact, right now, and it is titled "Sugar Consumption at a Crossroads," and I'm going to read from the policy initiatives blurb that they have on page, where is it? It's on page 26. It says, this is what they wrote. This is Credit Suisse. With few exceptions, regulators and health officials around the world have done little to address the impact of excess sugar consumption. We believe, this is Credit Suisse, we believe higher taxation on sugary food and drinks would be the best option to reduce sugar intake and help fund the fast-growing healthcare costs associated with type 2 diabetes and obesity. However, lobbying in this area has been fierce and has watered down or stopped major initiatives. This is a bank calling for taxation because even they get that this is unsustainable. They are telling their investors, there's a problem here. When business gets it, things start to happen.
Huh. So how does it feel being something of a fledgling policy wonk? Do you feel, that's how you describe yourself in the book. Is this an odd place to be?
This is where what I do now. Yeah. I just did a master's in law at UC Hastings very specifically to learn two things. Number one, when does a personal health issue become a public health crisis, and what are the legal doctrines surrounding that? For instance, HIV, for instance, tobacco. And then secondly, what was the tobacco playbook? How was it that they, 845 lawsuits, all were found for the tobacco industry until 1994? And then when the state attorney general for Mississippi sued tobacco for recoupment of Medicaid costs, it finally broke their back, and we got the master settlement agreement in 1996. The question is, what happened and how did it work? And that is what I'm interested in, and that is what I've now decided I'm going to spend the rest of my career trying to bring to fruition for sugar.
Robert Lustig. His book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Dr. Lustig joined us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Doctor, thank you very much again for the time.
Thank you for having me, Doug. Appreciate it.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.